Echo Depot here at DodecaCon with author John Jackson Miller. John, you've got a lot of books coming out, but let's start with Star Trek. For the past year and a half, you've been working on the Star Trek Prey trilogy, which will be coming out back-to-back-to-back over the next 3 months. Having accomplished this feat, if you could go back to when you first started the project, what advice would you give yourself?
Start earlier. One of the jokes that my wife and I had about the title, Star Trek Prey, P-R-E-Y, was that perhaps it should be Prey, P-R-A-Y, pray that it's on time. But I did get it out, and I just sent the third book's final version just went to the publisher yesterday, and or day before yesterday, and yeah, I'm really delighted with how it came out. You know, people ask me about the projects that I feel most strongly about, and you know, for different reasons, Knights of the Old Republic, I feel strongly about because it's really long. It was a very extensive project, but you know, the execution sort of varied depending on what was going on at the time, either with the art team or with my own schedule, or you know, external events such as Vector happening. Things were variable through the run to a degree. Then on the other hand, you have Kenobi, which, again, the New York Times bestseller, the Scribe Award winner, where I wouldn't change a word of anything. It's a smaller project, relatively speaking, in a single novel, but I feel that in terms of execution, everything I wanted to accomplish in that book was there. So I feel strongly about those two. Star Trek Prey combines both feelings, as far as I can say right now. It's very long in terms of, in comparison to the other projects I've worked on, you know, almost a third of a million words. That is a significant thing. But because I was able to write it all in a row, and there were many periods where I had all three books on my table at the same time to work on, I was able to make sure that I maintained the same level of quality throughout, you know, continuity, both within the Star Trek universe, within the Star Trek literary universe, and between the three books, should be airtight, because I many times had all three books simultaneously to work on, and so you will have an occasion where, if you're working on a long project, you know, you might have a thing happen in book three, and you realize, oh, it would have been great to have foreshadowed this in book one, but book one is gone, or book one is already on the stands. And, you know, the way that people release trilogies, mostly they do it a book at a time. And here, with this is something that Star Trek has done a couple of times before with the novels, to do them all three at once really made it possible for me to treat this as a single novel of three parts. And so yes, at this moment, I don't think I would change a word. I may feel differently after somebody proofreads the whole thing a final time. But
can you set the stage for listeners on what this trilogy is about?
This is a trilogy releasing here in the 50th anniversary, but it's actually the 100th anniversary of something else. I realized that we were 100 years out from Star Trek III, Star Trek IV, the motion pictures that were The Search for Spock and The Voyage Home. And it was in The Search for Spock that we met Commander Krug, played by Christopher Lloyd, the Give Me Genesis guy who, you know, not only do we meet him and get this notion of what life is like for the Klingon military, sort of in that post-TV series era, but you also get the feeling of the culture. This is where we get to see the language really brought in. It's the first place we see the Bird of Prey, which is, you know, one of my favorite starships ever. And, you know, naturally, I made sure there were Birds of Prey on every cover of Prey. So Krug was a Klingon who never would have tolerated what has happened in the 24th century the alliance between the Klingon Empire and the Federation. He definitely would have been one of those people in that conspiracy in Star Trek VI to stop what happened at Kittimer. And he never would have allowed that. We never found out much more about Krug other than that he killed his girlfriend in that movie. We didn't know anything else about his family. But there had been some previous stories that suggested that there was a House of Krug, a Klingon house which has property and forces of its own, you know, sort of in that, you know, the Japanese Bushido tradition, where you have, you know, the warriors working for the warlord of the house. And in the case of the House of Krug, I decided to establish that the house was a military industrial powerhouse, that the house specialized in manufacturing birds of prey. And I envisioned that there would be a battle for control of the house after his death in Star Trek III, and that we will see this conflict in the novel, in the first book, and then we see the results of that conflict. We see that there is an heir, a would-be heir, who is thwarted and rises to challenge Kirk and Spock in the first book, and is still around. There are a number of characters that from the 23rd century that can still be around in the 24th, because Klingons live more than 150 years, and so do Vulcans, and so do artificial intelligences and other kinds of aliens. So, you know, this gave me the opportunity to tell a story that had sections in both the original series era and the Next Generation. And most of it does take place in the Next Generation era, where Riker, who is now an admiral in the novels, is charged with helping the Klingon allies to commemorate the battle that settled control of the House of Krug, which is now 100 years old. And the reason that they're doing it in Federation space is because the location of the battle back in those days was unclaimed territory, but now it's a Federation planet. And so Riker calls upon Picard and Enterprise, who's very good at these sort of diplomatic things, to host this event. And things go from there. We have incidents that pile upon incidents. There are conspiracies. There are several mysteries that go through book one, book two, book three. Readers do not have to have read the other Star Trek novels to get a grounding and a feel for what's going on. But if people enjoy political thrillers, and of course we have a lot of property damage too, but political thrillers of that paranoid era, 1960s, movies like 7 Days in May, where there's a coup against the president, there are a number of things here that call back on that. Of course, Star Trek VI, the movie, was prototypical among Star Trek stories and calling back on those sorts of, you know, conspiracies and events. The trilogy gives me the chance to spread out and really explore these events. It takes place in real time. The novels are coming out in September, October, and November. The novels themselves each represent 1 month of continuity. This was very important because it allowed me to show not just a lot of things happening, but also the effect these things were having on the Klingon in the street. And we see a lot of parts of Klingon society we never saw before.
Will there be any noticeable stylistic changes between book one, book two, book three?
Certainly the situation grows increasingly dark. The Klingons form a major portion of this story, and Worf is present as our main through-line character through everything, but also a character we have not seen before in my fiction, and we have not seen much of in the fiction in general, and that is Kalus, the Emperor, the clone of Kalus the Unforgettable, that he appeared in one episode of the TV series and then The Next Generation. And then he was sort of put out to pasture in one of the previous short stories that had been done, one of the previous novellas, several years ago. I brought him back And I thought that he would be a great person to be central to these events. And so, again, the mood of the storyline with these characters starts in one place, and it does move. It does change. It does go forward. Certainly the Enterprise and the Titan, that's Riker's ship, and the Aventine, that's Dax's ship, spend a lot of time in pursuit. They spend a lot of time in investigation. This is a mystery. They're trying to find out what is causing this series of incidents that are happening. I would say there's a desperation that takes hold the longer we go into it. And again, the novels begin with Hell's Heart. Second book is called The Jackal's Trick. The third one is The Hall of Heroes. There is also a different principal antagonist in each of the three books. That too is, even though we have all three playing a role throughout the entire thing, we find out more about each one in each book.
Well, we see more of the Aventine in book two. I know there wasn't a lot of them in book one.
Aventine shows up later.
Okay.
And when it shows up, you'll see why it is a latecomer to the story. That's another indication of what is going on in this storyline. There's this all-hands-on-deck feeling that develops with the Federation as they're desperately trying to fix this problem. And Aventine, we will see where they've been and why they're not in the action in the beginning later in the series.
Aside from having to write three books back-to-back-to-back, what kind of challenges did you come up against in writing this trilogy?
Well, one of the things that I needed to do is make sure that I got all the research correct. And I had I actually brought a library cart to my desk just for the books and the novels and the atlases and the guides that I required. Of course, I used the Star Trek Star Charts book and the Star Trek Stellar Cartography maps, which are on my wall, so I would know exactly where in the Beta Quadrant I was during all of this. And I called upon the reference works and the online databases that were out there. There was a book, the Haynes Operator's Manual for the Klingon Bird of Prey. That was a wonderful product because it shows deck by deck by deck what is where and gives me a real specific information as to how the cloaking device works and where the points are that make it work and that sort of thing. That was really useful. Another thing I did, because there's a lot of Klingon culture in this, we invented some Klingon words. There's some Klingon language material. I went to somebody who is an expert in the Klingon language to sort of vet what we had in this book and to suggest some things. And you know, he's attributed in the books because it was so important. I wanted to have this thing feel like it was, that we made every effort to get it right.
Along those lines, what did you do to submerge yourself in that Klingon culture?
I kept my Bird of Prey over my desk. I have a Bird of Prey model hanging over my desk, sort of the sword of Damocles. It was there to sort of always remind me that was where I was. Again, I did keep the star charts on the walls. I went back and reviewed all of the key episodes of particularly The Next Generation, but also some material in Deep Space Nine involving the Klingons and their culture and their weaponry and how that all worked. And you know, I think probably maybe half the time in these novels is spent with the Klingons, and I wanted to make sure that was correct. The other thing is there is sort of a, I don't want to give it away, but there is a subset of Klingons in this storyline that come from a different point of view. And so I needed to put myself back in time and think about how their culture would have developed somewhat differently than what we see in the general Star Trek chronology. Another thing that I did was when I was writing the 23rd century sections of the books, I actually physically removed myself to another location to write. I took all my books and I went to an office at the local library, because a lot of the time I would be writing in both timelines at once. I'd be writing a 23rd century section during the day and the 24th century at night. I made sure that I was writing Kirk and McCoy and everybody during the day, where I was, you know, miles away from my office. And that alone sort of gets you into a different mindset. It's a little trick I learned.
To prep readers for reading the book, is there any, like, recommended reading or viewing you would have for them?
Yeah. I try to write everything so that it's accessible. You know, in general, if you just have a familiarity with Star Trek and transporters and Klingons, that helps. Specific viewing, Star Trek 3, certainly. Star Trek 6, I would think as well. There are callbacks to all the movies, but those in particular. The Next Generation episodes dealing with the Klingon Empire, particularly beginning with the one that really sold me, where we got to see the Klingon homeworld, the episode Sins of the Father, where Worf is discommandated. That's an important one. Rightful Heir, I think, is the title of the one where we meet Kalus. That's another good one to do. A lot of the Klingon Civil War episodes would be useful. But as people read the book, they will discover that there are callbacks, as I did in the Takedown novel. There are callbacks to other episodes that are kind of a surprise at the moment. You know, there are elements. There's an entire major subplot and subset of characters to these books that I haven't given any indication of in these discussions, because this is a mystery, what's going on and who's behind some of the things. And so I've really cautioned everybody about spoilers with this particular storyline.
There's some great character work in Hell's Heart, as well as a lot of layers to the story. But one ambitious thing you did was tackling the two time periods that bridge it together. This allows readers to enjoy the Enterprise crews of both Kirk and Picard. Was that something you wanted from the beginning for this project?
Once I knew it was a 50th anniversary project, it became certain that I would put that in. This is a project that over the course of, say, the almost 2 years that it was being developed, you know, the original plot, it was always my intention to illustrate this rupture between the Klingons and the Federation and to deal with the particular forces behind it. But it was not really until I had gone through one of the drafts and had feedback from CBS and from my editor that I really discovered and zeroed in on the particular sect that is involved with this story that precipitates the crisis. And once I thought about that, I realized it was obvious and easy to bring in the 23rd century, and in fact imperative, because it sets up what is going on later. And one of the nice things about it is the sequence that's in here, the Kirk McCoy Spock sequences that's in here, is more than simply a flashback. It's more than simply an Easter egg or window dressing. It's, you know, fully a quarter, close to a third of the book. And there are major elements that are planted there. It cannot be skipped over. And I'm not saying just yet, but people may discover that there are similar sections in the later books. And they might involve things that happen later in that timeline.
Are there any Easter eggs readers can look out for?
Well, certainly there are a variety of little winks here and there. And certainly, if people want to, you know, have their Star Trek star charts open, or have their Klingon Bird of Prey operator's manual open, they can really actually follow along the action in the locations. But certainly, little Easter eggs are there as well. I realized the other day, because someone had mentioned Star Trek the Motion Picture, and I was wondering whether I had any callbacks to that, and then I realized, yes, I have a sequence in the first book where just after, and where Kirk is situated in this story is soon after he has the Enterprise A. And I gave him a moment in the book where he's flying around and around and around the Enterprise in a work pod, which, of course, he does for an interminable period of time in Star Trek the Motion Picture, almost like he's looking for the door. And so I realized, yeah, that's kind of a wink right there.
Once readers finish reading the first book, Hell's Heart, what can they expect to see from The Jackal's Trick and then The Hall of Heroes?
Well, I tried to end with something that would be both satisfying on its own in each book, but also a cliffhanger on many levels that would want to draw people forward. And I do the same with The Jackal's Trick. The Jackal's Trick is somewhat more Riker-focused than the first book was, because as the crisis expands, it becomes much more of something where it's in his domain to deal with. We still have Worf, we still have Enterprise, but this thing has sort of escalated to the point where it's a much bigger deal for him, and so we see more of the Titan crew in the second book. And as I mentioned, once we get further in, it's all hands on deck, and we begin to see the other cast members as well. Tuvok in particular takes a central role in the second book, because while Picard has his team that's investigating everything that's going on, Tuvok is sort of the detective role player in our second book. And it's one of the fun things about doing these series of these books is you can put characters together that maybe didn't have much screen time at all together in the TV shows or movies, if any screen time. And so, yeah, it is really fun. It's already fun with Titan to imagine Riker and Tuvok playing off each other. I've done that before already in my Star Trek Titan novella called Absent Enemies. But I'm able to get some of these other characters to interact, and that's really fun.
Aside from Hell's Heart coming out this month, you also have a Halo short story coming out in Halo Fractures. What was it like diving into the Halo franchise?
Well, this was something fun in that I actually am in two Halo projects, and you may have this as a question for later anyway. I had already worked in a number of video game universes, probably most prominently Mass Effect, and certainly the Knights of the Old Republic comics involve significant interaction after the fact with what happened in the video games. But Halo was a new one for me, and it's a somewhat lighter or less dark milieu than you have in Mass Effect. And that's a bit more to my tastes in terms of military science fiction, because certainly there's a lot of range in Halo, but there are also heroic characters. And it's not always about a choice between the lesser of two evils. And that's kind of built into some other franchises. And so with Halo, they gave me the opportunity to work in different parts of the timeline. And what I always try to do when I'm starting out, particularly with a new franchise, is I look for stories that are limited in impact, stories that are of more personal impact. I don't go wallow in continuity right away, because I know that there are many people who know that material better than I do. For example, in the Halo book, Fractures, I wrote a story called Defender of the Storm, which involves a foot soldier for the Forerunners. And this is set 100,000 years and change before the current era. And I have this character who is, because of the nature of how his species develops, is sort of at an evolutionary dead end and also at a career dead end. And what I wanted to do was to have him, I wanted to confront that character with a crisis that would force him to go beyond what he feels his limitations are. And that's what we did there.
You also have a Halo comic coming out in October from Dark Horse, which will be Halo Tales from Slipspace. Does that tie in with the short story at all?
It does not. Halo Tales from Slipspace, as I understand it, I was instructed to come up with a story that follows the events of Halo Guardians, of Halo 5. I assume that the other stories are as well, although I haven't actually read them yet because the book does not come out until November. But this was a situation where it's a much different kind of a story, but it is characters in a similar predicament. They are, like my character in Halo Fractures, they're cut off from communication with their higher-ups. They are forced to make some fairly drastic decisions based on the situation that they are in. This one deals much more with the military. Yeah, so we're dealing with humans here. And yeah, I'll be really interested to see what it looks like. I haven't seen those pages yet. You know, this is the first comics work I've done for that universe. And also, it's the first comics work I've done in a good while. I'm glad I was able to get a chance to do that because I was able to get it in between, you know, novel projects. You know, there are several other stories in this anthology, but it is, you know, it's sort of a significant hardcover for the Halo fans, I think.
As if that wasn't enough, you also have a short story in Planet of the Apes, Tales from the Forbidden Zone, which will be out in January. What was writing that story like?
That was a lot of fun. This is a anthology for Titan that was edited by Rich Handley and Jim Beard. And the conceit about this is that they are all stories that are inspired by the original five Planet of the Apes movies, as well as the 1970s TV show, and maybe even the cartoon series, I'm not sure. But what was great about that is that I was able to take my favorite of those films, Escape from Planet of the Apes, where Cornelius and Zira returned to Earth in 1972. And because it was canonically 1972, I could do sort of a Hollywood story. This is almost like the movie The Player meets Planet of the Apes. It is about how the apes are treated by Hollywood society. We see them interacting to some degree in the movie at big Beverly Hills parties while they're on Earth. But I was able to tell a story that both is immersed in television production and trivia from that era, which I certainly love to do. But it also has this undercurrent of menace that is what you get in that movie as it goes onward and we start getting Otto von Hasselein's paranoia about the apes and the fact that they may destroy civilization. That begins to infect the story, and it is a lot of fun.
How did you manage to fit all these projects in while also doing three Star Trek books?
I had a challenging schedule. It was very difficult, and I wrote something like a third of a Megan Words in about 10 months. And it was good that I didn't have to do a lot of research on the Planet of the Apes story, but I didn't do many conventions in that period.
Is there anything else fans can look forward to? Anything you'd like to plug?
You know, I think, isn't that enough? I've got seven books coming out in the next 5 months because there's the three Star Trek Prey novels. There's the two Halo books. The Mass Effect Omnibus comes out in October or maybe early November. And that is the Dark Horse Omnibus that has my first three Mass Effect graphic novels in it. Of course, Planet of the Apes, so that's, what, seven? And then Knights of the Old Republic is being reprinted in the Epic Collection in March. The second volume of that is coming out. And that will be cool because that will have the first reprinting of the Star Wars handbook, Knights of the Old Republic handbook that we did over at the comics. But as far as future projects coming up, I have a number of things that I'm developing, and it's simply been, you know, writing all those novels and then proofreading all of them. You know, I took a couple of weeks off to redesign my website, and now I'm starting to do some promotions on some of these books, and hopefully there will be something I can announce fairly soon.
And with the holidays coming up, will you be offering some of your new books as autographed copies on your website?
Well, always, anyone could order off my website autographed copies of whatever I have available by going to the farawaypress.com shop page. And I am actually developing a online e-commerce portal there, so that'll make it a little easier.
All right, John, well, thank you.
I appreciate it.